first term to Trump in his second term from the Columbia's point of view. And you can see that manifesting in what we've seen this weekend. And as the professor has said, with reports of more ICE and DHS presence even up to today.
And Prem Tucker, the firing of, the forcing out of the professor, law professor, Catherine Franken, we just have 30 seconds. This also coming within this period. She was a law professor for almost a quarter of a century at Columbia.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And I believe the firing of Professor Catherine Franke, you can see more about that in our Zateo Town Hall today with her, actually. She is amongst an array of sort of victims, people caught up in the crossfire of being targeted, as Professor Hawley said, for this right-wing attack on academic freedom, on institutions, on free speech, on the ability for professors to advocate for their students to express their own free speech rights, to speak out against war, to speak out on behalf of Palestinians. And this is only a sort of broader sort of warning sign of what's to come if there is not an organized, coherent opposition.
We're going to have to leave it there, Prem Tucker. I want to thank you so much for being with us. Political correspondent, columnist for Zateo. We'll link to your articles. And Professor Hawley, thanks so much for joining.
Tune to KBOO Portland.
You're listening to KBOO's All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 4 Special Programming Campaign. Check out all the great special programs we're bringing you now through April 15th at kboo.fm/ATNF4.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, PGE gets the go-ahead to cut down nearly 400 trees in Forest Park.
Portland Street Response can now respond to more types of non-emergency calls.
And in national news, egg producers may be exploiting the avian flu crisis to increase the price of eggs.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 10th, 2025. I'm Mike Fdaklis.
And I'm Danny Shai. Portland General Electric, or PGE, will be allowed to cut down nearly 400 trees and fill in two wetlands in Forest Park, getting a thumbs up on their proposal to the city. The work would allow PGE to upgrade their existing transmission lines. A hearings officer for the City of Portland okayed the proposal, despite a searing city staff report that recommended it be denied. PGE says they need to upgrade their lines in order to meet the growing energy demand of the region. Conservationists say there were other ways of doing that work that doesn't involve cutting down so many trees in Forest Park. Tree canopy and habitat are part of what will be lost over 5 acres in Forest Park, something conservationists say Portland can't afford to lose. Future phases of PGE's plan could impact another 15 acres of the park, too, which advocates say wasn't adequately considered. Damon Moe's story is the chapter director of Sierra Club, Oregon. They told the Oregonian that the decision will allow, quote, for Portland General Electric to destroy wetlands, streams, and nearly 400 trees in Forest Park, many of which have been growing for hundreds of years, end quote. Advocates have until March 21st to appeal the decision.
Portland Street Response now has more options to offer support to those in mental or behavioral health crisis. Portland Mayor Keith Wilson announced new rules for Street Response, which sends a social worker and a medic to people in crisis. Now, Street Response can take someone to a homeless shelter or treatment service. They are allowed to come into government buildings and private businesses that are open to the public, like restaurants and stores. Street response is also now allowed to respond alongside police, the fire department, and paramedics in certain emergencies. This is a big expansion since the successful program was stagnated under the leadership of former City Commissioner Rene Gonzalez, who instituted a hiring freeze for the program. There are still some types of calls and services that street response can't provide. They can't respond to someone who has a weapon or who called related to suicide. They can't go into someone's house or on public transit. They can't put someone on an involuntary psychiatric hold, and they can't shuttle people to the hospital. Overall, the response to the expansion has been positive. Mayor Wilson said in a statement, quote, "Portland Street Response is a success story, and expanding its capabilities was a key campaign promise," end quote. The volunteer advocacy group, Friends of Portland Street Response, applauded the move, saying in a statement, quote, "The ability to both respond to more call types and voluntarily transport people to services furthers PSR's development as an effective and co-equal branch of the first responder system," end quote.
A new executive order from the Trump administration says Oregon and the United States must increase timber production in order to break the country's dependence on foreign timber and to protect against wildfires. As Isabel Charlet reports, people who work in forest policy say the order is out of touch and inaccurate. The Trump administration's recent executive order entitled Immediate Expansion of American Timber Production calls on federal land managers to ramp up timber production to protect the country's national and economic security. Oregon is the top producer of softwood lumber in the country, so the order could have serious implications for the state. Nick Cady is the legal director of Cascadia Wildlands in Eugene. He says the order's claim that onerous federal policies have forced the country to rely on imported lumber is incorrect. In fact, he says the U.S. is one of the world's leading timber exporters.
There are miles and miles of deck logs that are raw exported to Asia every day out of Coos Bay in the ports here in Oregon. So the premise which all of this is based on is false.
The order also states that a lack of logging has contributed to wildfires and degraded fish and wildlife habitats. Cascadia Wildlands and other environmental groups plan to take legal action against the order. Ryan Reed is on the Federal Advisory Committee for the Northwest Forest Plan. He says the executive order takes an extreme approach to logging. He adds the timber industry and environmentalists in the Northwest are more aligned than they used to be in their goals of managing forests sustainably. Reed says the order uses language of exploitation that indigenous leadership has been guiding the region away from.
This type of work is almost eroding the very work that we tried to build consensus and bring communities of both sides, of both interests, along.
If the order was enacted as written, Katie says, it could have devastating impacts on the region's forests and wildlife. But he adds that many environmental laws, including the Endangered Species Act, cannot be subverted through an executive order. Katie is confident that pending lawsuits will be successful.
I think in the end, it'll just lead to a bunch of taxpayer time and money fighting this in court, and then nothing on the ground and just kind of a smokescreen waste of time.
I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
The Trump administration continues to attempt the largest deportation effort in U.S. history. Their justification is that it will address the country's economic woes and increase job opportunities for citizens. But researchers say there's clear data to show a mass exodus would have the opposite economic effect, particularly in states that rely heavily on the migrant workforce. Judith Ruiz Branch reports.
As nationwide deportation efforts continue, new research examines the labor market of a past president to help forecast what could happen if President Donald Trump follows through on his plans. The Obama administration deported more than 3 million people. Trump says he wants to deport more to increase jobs for U.S. citizens. A new report from University of Colorado economic professor Chloe East says U.S. presidents have a long history of blaming immigration for the country's economic troubles, even when research shows the opposite. He says mass deportations and raids incite fear and leave vacant jobs that U.S. citizens are unlikely to fill.
We really don't see this substitution between unauthorized immigrants and U.S.-born workers in the way that we're promised we will by politicians. And in fact, the effect sort of goes even beyond this lack of substitution.
She says the industries most likely to be affected are construction, agriculture, manufacturing, and service jobs, with positions that that tend to be lower paid, tougher, or more dangerous. He says keeping these jobs filled actually helps to increase U.S. labor opportunities. About 17% of Illinois workers are immigrants, including some 55,000 seasonal farm workers. Inconsistencies about who exactly is being targeted by ICE agents raises concerns about racial profiling. A leaked memo shows efforts have pivoted from focusing on people committing crimes to migrant families and unaccompanied children with no criminal histories. Migrant workers make up about 20% of the U.S. workforce. East says it's striking to see history repeating itself.
Whether we're looking a few decades back or 100 years back, the results are very consistent and very clear that mass deportations are not the solution to any economic troubles.
While deportation data since Trump took office has yet to be released, the majority of news releases on the ICE website involve people from Mexico or Latin America. ICE says it will release updated deportation data every quarter. For Illinois News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch.
House Republicans demand the removal of D.C.'s Black Lives Matter Plaza. The Justice Department ends civil rights investigations, and the Trump administration vows to cut federal funding for schools that allow campus protests. With more on the story, it's Catherine Carley with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We have bigger fish to fry than fights over what has been very important to us and to the history, and especially our ability to keep our city safe during that time.
Washington, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser says she won't argue with the White House over its request to rename the city's Black Lives Matter Plaza. A BLM mural covering two downtown blocks became a focal point for residents following the murder of George Floyd. The decision to paint over the mural comes after House Republicans moved to force Bowser to rename the area Liberty Plaza or risk losing federal funds. The Department of Justice has dropped its lawsuit against Texas, arguing the state's legislative and congressional maps violate the Voting Rights Act. Texas civil rights activist Antonio Arellano says the current maps dilute the voting power of Latinos.
The redistricting process is all about who's going to have money and power for the next decade. 95% of the population growth was led by people of color. That's exactly who should be calling the shots in Texas.
The Justice Department has also withdrawn from a Biden-era voting rights case against Virginia over the removal of names from voter rolls. Officials in Georgia have requested the DOJ drop a lawsuit over the state's 2021 overhaul of election laws. Speaker Mike Johnson has introduced a bill to keep the government funded through September and avoid a government shutdown this week. It increases spending for defense and deportations while cutting more than $13 billion from domestic programs. A bipartisan group of nearly 1,000 political scientists have denounced Donald Trump's administration for rapid cuts to programs and staff. Montana State University professor Sarah Rushing says democracy is not a business and requires checks and balances.
We have these procedures and practices built in to slow things down, build consensus, abide by processes, and make sure that things are fair and transparent.
The White House counters it's merely holding federal agencies accountable as required by the Constitution. The administration has canceled more than $400 million in grants and contracts with Columbia University, claiming the school has not done enough to combat anti-Semitism on campus. But Carol Garvin with the ACLU of Maine says the threat to funding has a partisan edge well beyond what the White House calls illegal protests over the Israel-Hamas war.
Regardless of what the root of the protest is, it could be used to pressure universities to clamp down on protests whenever the protests express a view that the Trump administration disagrees with.
Trump has threatened to deport international students who take part in protests. Immigration agents arrested a Palestinian graduate student and Columbia protest organizer over the weekend. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Officials in Winnipeg, Canada, have identified human remains at a landfill site belonging to an Indigenous woman who was murdered by a convicted serial killer. With that story and more, it's Brian Bull with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. Officials in Manitoba have identified one of two sets of remains found last month at a Winnipeg landfill site. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, police have confirmed those remains belong to one of four Indigenous women murdered by a convicted serial killer.
The remains of Morgan Harris were positively identified by forensic officials. They were found 2 weeks ago at a landfill north of Winnipeg. A second set of remains have not yet been identified, but are likely those of another victim of serial killer Jeremy Skibitzky, an Indigenous woman known only as Buffalo Woman. Advocates for missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and gender-diverse people are praising the Harris family for their strength and determination after they fought for the search of the landfill site. Praise also came from Manitoba Premier Wab Kanu.
So I don't think any of us would ever want our loved ones to go through what Morgan Harris went through. However, through this journey, we have seen some remarkable strength and resilience and power from the family of Morgan.
A former Grand Chief of a group of Northern Manitoba First Nations, Sheila North, also acknowledged the strength and love of the families for their efforts. And Wab Kanu says he hopes the family will have some sense of closure and healing now that they will be able to hold a sacred ceremony to memorialize her. The families of missing and murdered Indigenous women and children worked alongside forensic anthropology students to search the landfill. Some Indigenous leaders and advocates who pushed for the search said the remains wouldn't have been found without the efforts of the Canadian government and the current provincial government. Winnipeg police and the former Conservative government of Manitoba argued against searching the landfill because of safety concerns. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Joe, do you copy? Joe, it's Chief.
The hit thriller mystery show Dark Winds kicked off its third season over the weekend. The new episodes have Navajo police officers Joe Leaphorn and Jim Chi investigating the disappearance of two boys and an FBI agent probing the death of the wealthy and powerful B.J. Vines from last season. Zahn McLarnon plays Leaphorn.
Season 3 is basically a continuation, exploration of the tragedy that befell the Leaphorn family from the previous seasons with their son, the ramification of their son's death, and what consequences come to Joe Leaphorn for his actions he did last season, how it affects his mental state, and how it affects his marriage with his wife, Emma.
The third lead in Dark Winds is Jessica Matten, who plays Bernadette Manulito. Season 3 finds her hundreds of miles away working with the U.S. Border Patrol. Matten wasn't available for an interview with National Native News, but co-star Kiowa Gordon says her character and Jim Chi still connect.
Jim's not one to give up on something that he wants in his life, so I don't think we've seen the last of that pairing between Bernadette and Jim Chi, because even though there may be some love triangle forming through this Ivan character, you know, I think we can't ever count out Chi and Bernadette having a reunion, and I'd hold on to that hope.
Meanwhile, showrunner John Wirth says the series' success comes from revisiting Tony Hillerman's novels through the lens of Navajo and other Native American cast and crew members, including consultants.
It's a wonderfully functional, dysfunctional group of people. All of us have the same desire to tell a really gripping story and to honor the traditions out of which these characters come, both the fictional world of Hillerman and also the historical world and the real world of the Navajo Nation.
Dark Winds airs Sunday on AMC. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios in Eugene, Oregon.
To the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Ranch Radio. In this episode, host Michael Gaskill asks the question, is the Forest Service using the threat of wildfire to increase logging? At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, it did happen here. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 40 degrees. Tomorrow, there's a chance of rain and a daytime high of 51. Today in history, it's Harriet Tubman Day. The day recognizes the significant work of the abolitionist and worker on the Underground Railroad. Tubman helped to free over 70 people, leading them to the Northern Free States and Canada. The quote of the day is from Tubman, who said, quote, I had reasoned this out in my mind. There was one of two things I had a right to, liberty or death. If I could not have one, I would have the other.
U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, or HHS, is one of the U.S. government's costliest federal agencies, with an annual budget of about $1.7 trillion. That money is mostly spent on health care coverage for people enrolled in Medicare and Medicaid, but HHS also promotes health in other ways. It supports research on medical treatments into cancer and other major diseases, provides social services to vulnerable populations, including financial assistance, health care, and social support, and ensures the safety and quality of food, drugs, and medical devices. The agency oversees health insurance for roughly half the country through Medicare for older adults and Medicaid for disabled and poor Americans. Most of the 80,000 federal workers responsible for researching disease, inspecting food, and administering Medicare and Medicaid under HHS were emailed an offer to leave their jobs for as much as a $25,000 payment. The email was sent to staff in the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the National Institutes of Health, and the Food and Drug Administration. Workers could start opting in today and have until 5 p.m. on Friday to submit a response to the so-called voluntary separation offer. The mass email went out just days before agency heads are required to offer plans for cutting their workforces. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Trump's new HHS secretary, has already hinted at plans at deep staff cuts. He said he would immediately clear out 600 employees at the NIH, the nation's primary biomedical research arm. He more recently added he wants to remove some workers from the public agencies, specifically workers who helped create nutrition guidelines he disagreed with. The Trump administration, with the help of unelected advisor Elon Musk, has been trying to push out federal workers, attempting to crater spending and the functionality of the federal government. In January, most federal employees received a deferred resignation offer that came with 8 months of pay. In addition, thousands of probationary employees have been fired from many federal agencies, including HHS. The latest move to reduce the number of federal health workers comes just as the Centers for Disease Control is helping fight a deadly measles outbreak in West Texas and New Mexico, and as lawmakers are debating deep cuts to Medicaid.
Consumer advocates have released a new report that says corporate egg producers are blaming the current avian flu outbreak for a spike in egg prices, despite evidence that costs were already on the rise before the outbreak. Mark Morin has the details in Iowa.
A new report by the group Food and Water Watch says egg companies are exploiting the bird flu outbreak for profit in Iowa. Data show egg prices in the Midwest were already sharply higher long before the latest wave of avian flu. Some 75% of egg-laying hens are raised on almost 350 factory farms in the U.S., each housing about 850,000 birds. Now, over $5 a dozen, egg prices in Iowa grocery stores are nearly twice what they were 2 years ago. Rebecca Wolf with Food and Water Watch says highly consolidated corporate egg producers are using the outbreak and their market control to drive the numbers still higher, even though egg production costs have remained nearly flat.
Prices rising before the bird flu outbreak and now an astronomical impact with the actual real impacts of the bird flu, which is a classic case of what we say price gouging consumers. So really taking advantage of that market control.
Iowa raises more egg-laying hens on factory farms than any other state, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says Iowa has lost nearly 30 million birds in the current avian flu outbreak. As the nation's leader in raising egg-laying hens, Wolf says Iowa's consolidation makes the industry fragile and highly sensitive to any disruption. She claims operators designed it that way.
So if one bird is sick in one of those 300-some facilities, which is what we're seeing, then all of those birds, in this case, have been culled for the bird flu.
Chickens are more susceptible to disease in cramped confinements, and concentrated manure also threatens air and groundwater quality. Industry operators say they're trying to address potential environmental pollution while meeting consumer demand for high-quality poultry. I'm Mark Moran for Iowa News Service.
As egg prices rise, more people are becoming interested in raising backyard chickens. But just because the birds are close to home doesn't mean they're safe from avian flu. Suzanne Potter has more.
With egg prices through the roof, more people are taking an interest in raising backyard chickens. But experts warn that comes with significant risk because avian flu is spreading rapidly. You might think backyard chickens are safer from bird flu than large commercial farms because the flocks are smaller and coops are less crowded, but Professor Benjamin Anderson with the University of Florida says backyard flocks can be infected by droppings or saliva from wild birds passing through.
California has been dealing with large outbreaks of H5N1 bird flu over the last year, so I would not advise people picking up backyard poultry for the first time unless they feel really good about the training they've received about doing it in a safe way.
Over the last month, more than 50 backyard flocks have tested positive for bird flu across the country. In December, a person in Louisiana who came in contact with dead birds from a backyard flock became the first American to die in this avian flu outbreak. The entire West Coast is part of the Pacific Flyway, which raises the risk of migratory wild birds coming into contact with backyard flocks. Professor Maurice Pateski is an expert in poultry disease modeling at the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. He says to protect your birds, you must practice good biosecurity and animal husbandry.
Not having spilled feed, having good fencing, having clothing and boots that are dedicated to going in the coop. Now I recommend that people also wear surgical masks and some kind of covering over their eyes.
Pateski says if more people got a flu shot, it would make it harder for the avian flu to mutate into a strain that human immune systems may not be able to fend off.
That can reduce the potential for human influenzas and avian influenzas to mix. And when they do mix, they have the potential for creating new strains that are novel, virulent, and highly infectious.
The CDC guidelines for backyard chicken owners recommend limiting human access to them and keeping poultry in enclosed spaces to minimize exposure to wild birds. This story was produced with original reporting by Gabriella Sotelo for Sentient. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
As health scientists try to get a better handle on the avian flu, research efforts are also under review by the Trump administration. Alex Gonzalez has more.
Bird flu has infected close to 1.7 million birds and hundreds of cattle herds, including some in Arizona. Dozens of humans have been infected, but the risk remains low, according to the CDC. But some scientists are growing worried that could change. Former chief public health veterinarian for the USDA, Dr. Pat Basu, says as the Trump administration reviews federal government spending, animal disease outbreak research, such as the Animal Health and Disease Research Capacity Program, is being put in jeopardy.
The last thing we need is this controls disease outbreaks. And through this program, which is part of USDA, provides tens of billions of funding to states and to these organizations, universities, to carry out high-value research.
The AHDR program is funded by the National Institute for Food and Agriculture, which is a federal research and grant-making body. In a statement, the Institute said all NEPA requests and applications are currently under review. The NEPA program supports avian flu and other animal disease research at universities and veterinary colleges. The USDA also funds research into avian flu through the National Animal Disease Preparedness and Response Program. That program also provides tens of millions in funding to states, organizations, and universities to execute projects on animal disease outbreaks. Basu says the government needs to ensure the program is prioritized.
We need to make sure this remains strong. The funding is kept alive, part of the farm bill, which I'm not sure how when it's going to be renewed again. So these things are important to reevaluate, maybe, but not cut off without looking at it and understanding the importance of that.
Basu wants to encourage those in D.C. to consider what he calls a holistic approach to dealing with animal diseases.
But you can't fight the disease by looking at just one side of the situation. You have to look at the whole thing, and the whole thing needs from top to bottom, all the species, including humans, and have all the people staffed correctly.
For Arizona News Connection, I'm Alex Gonzalez. This story was produced with original reporting from Gray Moran for Sentient.
State and federal leaders have been working with rural broadband providers to close high-speed internet gaps. But a pending case before the U.S. Supreme Court could upend progress in maintaining service. As Mike Moen reports, South Dakota advocates say residents in smaller towns could be left scrambling depending on the outcome.
Later this month, the U.S. Supreme Court hears arguments in a case that challenges the constitutionality of a federal fund that aids rural broadband service. South Dakota advocates say a negative outcome could be devastating for customers. A conservative organization brought the case, hoping to end an SEC fee that flows into what's known as the Universal Service Fund. It provides $8 billion a year for telecommunications programs geared toward underserved populations. That includes high-speed internet service in rural areas. Kara Semler of the South Dakota Telecommunications Association worries about the impact if the challenge is successful.
Children will be missing out on educational opportunities. Businesses will lose their competitiveness.
Industry groups say service rates for customers benefiting from the fund will double if it's struck down. The plaintiffs contend the fee mechanism used to prop up the fund is more like a tax, meaning Congress should have the oversight. Semler says shifting that power would result in annual funding uncertainty for an industry that relies on long-term planning. Cell phone service providers and other telecom companies pay for the fee that's at the center of the legal argument. Those costs are passed along to consumers across the country through their monthly bills. Semler says it's a small price to pay to maintain critical broadband infrastructure in rural pockets.
It's that ongoing operation, maintenance, and affordability of the product. It does no good to have infrastructure in the ground if it becomes unaffordable for South Dakota consumers to use.
Semler says they've had productive conversations with South Dakota's congressional delegation about Plan B strategies, but she acknowledges the budget-cutting tone in Washington, D.C. right now, while adding it would be hard for state government to fill any sudden funding gaps. This is Mike Mullen for Greater Dakota News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 10th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Sherry Meredith.